In early August, the Nimono team was talking about ideas for our election coverage, the potential for violence, attempts to subvert the vote, and the importance of media literacy. It's not hyperbole to state that this is the most important election we have ever taken part in. It is imperative that we not only are informed about our voting rights, but we ensure that they are protected. That means becoming savvy about misinformation and disinformation and the ways that you and some people you may know are possibly being manipulated.
We have been studied. Our cultures have been studied. Our vernacular has been studied. These bad actors, they know the different colloquialisms that we use. When we counter these type of disinformation efforts, we have to do it with the same thrust, with even more vigor and sensitivity.
Words from Jessica Ann Mitchell Awuyor that need to be listened to. All right, buckle up because we have a lot we're going to present to you. We have artificial intelligence policy advisors, the founder of Generation Justice, the New Mexico chapter leader for Media Literacy Now, and a word about how to tell real news from the fake stuff from the public library. I know I returned those books. It's been years. Nimono starts now. On Wednesday, the 21st, the New York Times released an article that detailed findings from federal officials that claim Iran and Russia have obtained voter registration data. I don't have to tell you, this is no good. It appears that Iran has used the information they got a hold of to send threatening fake emails to potential voters, i.e. misinformation. And a new poll is showing that voters who aren't white are concerned about violence, militias, and police if they go to cast their ballot in person. We know that some of you have voted already and others have voted by mail, but anyone who is preparing to get in line on the 3rd know that your right to vote is protected by many laws, agencies, and officials. No one has the right to threaten you, harass you, or intimidate you at the polls. Any elections official who discriminates against an in-person voter faces a $5,000 fine or up to 5 years in prison. Anyone who conspires to deprive someone of their right to vote faces up to 10 years in prison. No one can confront you at the polls under law, raise their voice with you, threaten you, or insult you. Law enforcement isn't allowed at the polls except to vote or to maintain order if something gets out of hand. And people who aren't police can't go to the polls dressed like law enforcement either. That's under the law. If anyone messes with you and if you're treated unfairly, there are steps that can be taken that will handle the situation. First, call the voter protection hotline at 866-OUR-VOTE, 866-OURVOTE. They have people ready to talk to you in multiple languages. Common Cause New Mexico and the ACLU have created this hotline for you to report any interference and irregularities. That number again, 866-OUR-VOTE. Also, call the Secretary of State's office, 800-477-3632. Your right to vote is and will be protected. Our democracy depends on it. David Carroll is one of the nation's leading advocates for data rights and an associate professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design. In 2019, he successfully sued Cambridge Analytica, the now defunct British political consulting company, for his data that was collected and used for the 2016 Trump campaign. We spoke on Your New Mexico Government in June about internet privacy and data rights. He said he would love to talk with us again during the election season, and here he is on the new show. I'd like to welcome Professor David Carroll to Nimono. Thanks for being with me.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me out.
So when we talked in June, you were waiting for your internet data that you won access to in this legal proceeding against Cambridge Analytica. And about a month ago, you were finally able to see it. Tell me about what you found in the data. How deep did they go into your social media or your data profile?
As it turns out, a heroic act of journalism is what ended up giving me my data. I did get some data back in 2017. I knew it wasn't the whole file. The legal case was really about, no, I know this is not it. Show all of my data. And so what Channel 4 showed me was a much more complete dossier of not only my voting and political profile, but a pretty extensive consumer profile, which had been collected from various data brokers. And it also contained a psychological score.
Okay, so that goes into the realm of psychographics. Can you briefly explain to the listeners what psychographics are, what it is?
Psychographics is a subfield of psychology. It's pretty controversial. It is known as the Big Five, or also known as OCEAN, which stands for five dimensions of personality. It stands for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And the idea is we could take a personality survey and then we could get a score which would show us how we fit in the percentiles. So, you know, sort of how above or below average we are on these dimensions. And that's exactly what was in my file.
Okay. And it looks like they used that. I believe one of the campaign associates said that they didn't. It seems to be a conflict or a flat out lie.
You know, that if it was a good feeling that I wasn't crazy, that I was right, that they did collect these profiles on all registered voters. And you didn't have to be one of the people who had your Facebook account pilfered, that it happened to all of us. So that was very vindicating and showed the wider concern that this was way beyond Facebook and that this is really standard practice in the industry.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that psychographics that they used in the 2016 campaign, do you think that has a connection to why the polls were so wrong that year?
We don't know enough, unfortunately, to determine that. You know, there was a recent document trove related to a campaign finance complaint that was filed last week. And in that document trove that was made publicly available, we did get the first examples of Cambridge Analytica showing some specific ways that the targeting worked. And so one example would be in working for a super PAC, not the campaign, they did this targeting and they found that fear-based subject lines in emails had a 20% higher open rate when targeted to people with a very high neuroticism score. That's sort of one of the first times we can look at some tangible, measurable effects that the targeting could be potentially more effective when you're trying to convey a particular fear-driven message to people who are particularly susceptible to that.
That leads me to think about regulation. Is it time to, you know, the auto industry is regulated, big tobacco is regulated, the airline industry is regulated. Is it time to regulate social media and tech companies?
Yes, the mantra among the industry has been up until now, you know, don't regulate the internet because you'll harm innovation. But I think that those days are over. The, you know, first moments of signaling that those days are over were 2 years ago when the Cambridge Analytica scandal broke. In many ways, the California Consumer Privacy Act was passed in part because of the scandal, that the industry's resistance to that ballot initiative and then state law was effectively neutralized when anyone brought up the words Cambridge Analytica. So that's, you know, continuing on. And then this week's announcement that the Department of Justice and many attorneys general are suing Google for antitrust is a serious signal that the days of unfettered tech companies are coming to an end. I think a moment when I knew that was coming was actually during the Cambridge Analytica scandal, when Mark Zuckerberg was, you know, on the Hill and a conservative Republican lawmaker asked Mark Zuckerberg what he thought about the European data protection law, the general data protection regulation. You know, I never thought I'd see the day when a conservative Republican would ask a tech baron, tell me what you think is good about European law.
What was his response?
It was in the context of, you know, Zuckerberg in a very particular way, acknowledging that, yes, you know, the tech companies do need to be regulated, do want to participate in the discussion about regulation, that they want rules of the road. You know, ultimately, they do want to know how to abide by acceptable practices. And they don't like actually being the arbiters of these rules. And we can see recently how they flail and fumble when lawmakers and our government are telling them this is acceptable, this is not, this is legal, this is not. They're just making it up as they go along. In the end, it's in their best interest to be regulated so that they won't be responsible for the things that ail them. And the other thing that the industry is worried about is if states make their own laws, like California is doing, that they'll become a patchwork of different privacy laws that will make it very difficult for the industry to navigate.
You mentioned lawmakers, and are there any lawmakers, national lawmakers, who are willing to take up the mantle of data rights and propose something?
Yes. Before the pandemic, there was some really interesting movement in Washington, D.C. on the subject of a National Privacy Act. And both sides of the aisle were working on interesting bills. I found that Senator Ed Markey's bill was one of the more interesting ones that I had seen and I was getting pretty excited about. Senator Gillibrand had a draft circulating, and Marco Rubio had a draft circulating. So there was some interesting energy, but the pandemic squashed that. And so it's unfortunate that it did, because obviously the pandemic raises a whole new set of privacy issues, but you can understand why the attention shifted away from this.
You know, there's been a lot of misinformation on social media prior to the election and this election season, the entire year, along with COVID, misinformation, disinformation, along with Black Lives Matter, misinformation and disinformation. The president has already said that he is going to question and put in doubt the results of the election if he loses. Do you see a flood of fake reports of calling a winner, a projected winner, fake accusations of cheating and scandal? Do you see this growing worse post-election?
Glad you brought this up. This is a really significant concern. It's one of the reasons why I joined the so-called Real Facebook Oversight Board, which is, you know, a sort of emergency group of academics and journalists and activists who are specifically concerned about misinformation related to the democratic process. And we've been trying to make specific demands of Facebook, and hopefully other platforms will follow on. And one of the demands that we had, and platform seems to be trying to act, is preventing candidates from prematurely declaring a result. And that would be a specific example of something to help create chaos and uncertainty, especially as an unprecedented number of mail-in ballots could delay the result and interfere with our expectation that we know of a result at 1 a.m. on election day. So this is a big concern. It's going to be a big challenge for the platforms. They may not succeed, so we need to not rely on them. We need to, you know, do our own work as citizens to make sure that we defend the result. I'm old enough to remember the year 2000 when the Supreme Court picked the president. And I really hope that we're not in a position again for that to happen.
He is Professor David Carroll. Thank you again for being with me. Really appreciated our conversation.
Thanks so much.
The National Black Cultural Information Trust is a pan-African initiative that corrects and challenges cultural misinformation and disinformation surrounding racial ethnic identity, anti-blackness, and other false narratives that harm black communities. I spoke with its founder, Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor, and here's our conversation in progress. Jessica, let me ask, what kinds of disinformation are you aiming at to fight during the election? What are you seeing out there?
So we are really aiming at combating and countering cultural disinformation. Mm-hmm. So this is disinformation that is targeting Black communities, but using cultural conversations to do it, using cultural issues and internal discussions that we have, often on public platforms, as a way to inject or insert false information, stir confusion, or influence the way that we think.
You know, I've seen a lot of conflicting things on social media regarding the Breonna Taylor case, regarding Black Lives Matter, even some regarding what's happening with SARS in Nigeria. These are the type of things you all are fighting?
So for the election, the type of cultural disinformation that we find is this push to sway Black Americans to believe they have nothing to benefit from voting, that both parties are completely against African Americans and have given nothing. So we should withhold our votes until we get reparations. So this is a disinformation campaign using the very important issue of reparations, which is something that African Americans have been advocating for a very long time. It is a real movement for reparations, but they use this conversation to try to sway us to not participate in the presidential election.
You know, what you are doing, you've founded this trust that fights cultural misinformation about African Americans in social media by making facts and sources readily available to the public. You're doing journalism the way it's supposed to be done, you and your colleagues. But what does that go to say when people just think that, you know, African Americans are going to go to Black Twitter or look at World Star for information? What is it going to take to really educate everyone, but including the African American social media and internet media, using communities to kind of spread the information that they get?
Well, I think we have to do our jobs to spread awareness ourselves, specifically online. People generally don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
When we go online or we go on Twitter, we don't think, hi, I'm opening up this disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we're going here to share information or look at something funny or things like that. But at the end of the day, what is happening is these social media channels have become mass manipulation tools. We do a disservice to our communities by falsely believing that we are completely monolithic. But at the same time, what needs to be understood is the cultural thread. Mm. And that is what has often been missing from these conversations. We have been targeted not just for disinformation, but for our cultures.
Mm.
We have been studied. Our cultures have been studied. Our vernacular has been studied. The way in which we present has been studied. And so these bad actors know this about us. They know the different colloquialisms that we use.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we counter these type of disinformation efforts, we have to do it with the same thrust, with even more vigor and sensitivity, knowing that it has come to that specific of a point,
mm-hmm.
that a person's, the way that they speak or they dress or the way that we name ourselves has become a part of a way to turn it on ourselves and manipulate our community.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to spread that awareness to even let people know that this is happening so that they can be on the lookout for it. What we're working on at National Black Cultural Information Trust is we're about to release an info guide on disinformation mm-hmm. for Black social media users. And this info guide is short and succinct, and it's going to address the fact that bad actors are using our cultural issues to cause confusion,
mm-hmm.
and the different things that we can do and what to look out for and how not to get sucked in and how not to participate in it and what to share and what not to share.
Mm-hmm.
It's like walking down a dark path and you need to get somewhere, but in order to get somewhere, somebody has to turn the light on. We have to turn the light on, let people really see what's happening. So the disinformation guide includes visuals. It includes screenshots so they can say, hey, I've seen something like that before and I never thought anything about it. But now that you say something, mm-hmm. yeah, I've seen a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make sure that people are more and more aware and target them where they are. Speak to people where they are.
Yeah. When will your resource be available and where can people find it?
Well, it's actually going to be available tomorrow. We're going to publish it on our website at nbcit.org. It will be prominent. We also have public service announcements that are downloadable, both video and audio, that can be used for free on anybody's platform.
Thank you so much. She is Jessica Ann Mitchell Iwuyor. She is with the National Black Cultural Information Trust. Thank you again, Jessica.
Thank you.
Mutale Akande is the founding CEO of AFP, AI for the People. It's a nonprofit communications agency that works to eliminate underrepresentation of Black professionals in the American technology sector. She is also an artificial intelligence policy advisor, an expert on race studies in tech, a mother of two, and an all-around phenom. This summer, we talked for YNMG and are honored to have her on No More Normal. Mutale, welcome.
Khalil, it is so good to be back, and there is no way that what we're going through can be normal, so I feel like I'm with friends.
Yes, yes, you are. So let's talk. You know, last week, Facebook and Twitter, they came once again into the headlines as they put heavy restrictions on a New York Daily News article about the Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's son, Hunter. U.S. intelligence officials state that the story sources come from a Russian misinformation campaign similar to what was done in the 2016 election. Facebook and Twitter have proven to be effective tools to spread misinformation, and now they're beginning to step up and prevent questionable stories from being shared. First question for you. Is what they did last week sufficient? Is that enough?
First of all, I'm going to start by applauding the fact that they did something. Mm-hmm. Because as you alluded, this is basically Pizzagate, right?
Yeah.
But it's Pizzagate 2020. And what happened in that particular instance is nothing was done, and somebody showed up to a pizza shop that did not have a basement with a gun trying to get into the basement. So I do think that in taking action, it was definitely a step forward. Mm-hmm. I think the big debate that we're all living through is, was it the right action? And I know that's not quite the question you asked. You asked if it's enough.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue, I sit on the TikTok content advisory board, and one of the things that we always argue is just about algorithms being used in a way for good constantly. The problem with that is that you would have to reshape capitalism. And so I think they're never going to do that. So that's a non-answer to your question, but it's the best answer I have.
So that's interesting, because I want to talk to you about algorithms. You're an expert in machine learning. From what you just said, it seems like this equation is out of our control. It's too late to make any changes to it.
No, it definitely isn't too late to make any changes, but we do need to rework incentives, mm-hmm. which is more than the tech companies, right? We need real regulation. We need to figure out what's going to happen with antitrust negotiations as the House have met on this. And we also need to have more than just Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey deciding the governance of these structures. So at this point, it's not a technical issue. This is an issue of governance.
So it's more regulatory, and it's up to Congress to really enact regulations. I just spoke with David Carroll, and we were talking about regulating the tech industry the same way tobacco, airlines,
big pharma. We're at that stage. This industry is 20 years old. It's no longer just wearing hoodies and sneakers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
And as it comes out of its adolescence, we need to have guardrails, because this is the most powerful communications mediums that we have ever seen in human history. And we need to make sure that multi-stakeholders are involved in how we interact with them.
You know, it grows harder each day to determine what's real information and what's not. And we've seen misinformation campaigns take hold in the BLM movement. So are we at a point where there's any movement that happens, any type of situation, is that prey to immediate confusion and misinformation these days?
I guess to answer that question, I have to also share the history of disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
So it was developed by the KGB at the beginning of the 1950s. And at the time, and still to this day, what disinformation agents do is that they will take a story that is true. They will insert a piece of information that is not true, so a lie, and then use that lie to cause division within their target population. So if we look at the Hunter Biden case, it is a fact that Hunter Biden thankfully recovered from addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
yes.
is true. What was not true was this idea, you know, this idea of the emails. Leaks are actually part of the disinformation playbook. They have been used throughout the last 50 years to transmit information about people that's real and unflattering and that will change their opinion. If you think about the WikiLeaks, for example, and Hillary's emails,
mm-hmm.
And so whenever you have a movement, whenever you have an idea, whenever you have something that captures the public imagination, it becomes prey because it has already got momentum. So if you have a movement like the Movement for Black Lives, and they are pushing one narrative, which is generally positive. If you're a Black person that believes Black people should be treated with dignity and have the same rights as everybody else, you would view it as positive. Something negative around that can be implanted. Okay. And we've seen, for example, Black Lives Matter protesters, and I say that with inverted commas around the word protesters, who are actually people who are out to loot and cause harm, but they're tagging buildings with BLM because the lie is that want to portray this particular organization as violent, and in violence, the disinformation narrative can go from there.
Mm-hmm. I see. Are you and your colleagues, are you creating algorithms? Is there like a war of algorithms going to go on like the movie Tron?
We're not creating algorithms, but we are looking to game the algorithms. So if we can get more engagement in a positive message around COVID and around voting than a negative message, because these disinformation agents aren't creating algorithms, they are just co-opting algorithms. So if you can game an algorithm for bad, we want to know whether you can also game it for good. So we will be measuring engagement and reporting out on that.
I want to thank you so much again for being back on the show. She is Mutale Nkande, an AI expert and policy advisor. She's also the CEO of AI for the People. Mutale, thank you so much.
I am so thrilled to be back, and I look forward to letting you know whether we were able to game that algorithm.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Andrea Serrano is the executive director for the Organizers in the Land of Enchantment, also known as OLE. The group focuses on reforming economic systems and electoral engagement. I spoke with Andrea earlier this month about disinformation and voter suppression as early voting was getting started here and around the country.
We've already been seeing voters being intimidated at polls, and we know that there's a long history of voter intimidation and voter suppression, especially among Black and brown communities. What we see a lot in New Mexico is more of a subtle and sometimes even undetectable threat. We are in a global pandemic, and the safest way to vote is for people to vote by mail. And it's safe, it's secure. Troops have been doing it for decades and decades and decades. But when you have someone who's intentionally trying to sabotage a really safe way of voting, that on its face is voter suppression. Who's affected by that are mostly people of color. In New Mexico, we're a people of color majority state, and we see that people of color are the lowest groups that are turning out to vote. And so the rates that we're turning out to vote don't match our population, which means we're not being represented at the polls. When you're sowing these ideas that voting isn't safe or it isn't going to be secure, then what you're doing is you're further driving down those numbers of Black and brown voters.
Now, you're talking about misinformation that people are giving and spreading to disenfranchise and discourage Black and brown voters and other people from voting as well. So what are some of the ways that people are being misinformed about their right to vote? Are tools like social media and robocalls and mailers with the wrong information being used?
We've seen that in the past. So in the past, there's definitely been mailers that have been sent out that have the wrong date, that have the day after the election. What we're seeing now is much more of a technological threat. So what we see are actually bots. And I know we hear about that a lot, to the point now where people either don't understand what that means or they're just sort of, you know, not paying attention anymore. But bots really are a threat. They're not real social media accounts, but they mimic real social media accounts. And what they do is they actually sow discord among voters. With they start putting out these really negative messages like, you know, our votes don't matter and they don't listen to us anyway and we shouldn't vote because they don't care about us anyway. And they target Black, Indigenous, and people of color. There's the pieces that are in your face. We saw it in the debate, the presidential debate, where saying to the Proud Boys, you know, stand back and stand by. And, and you know, there's this big push to recruit 50,000 poll observers from the Republican Party. So we see those kinds of in-your-face threats. But then there's the subtle stuff, what we see rampant on social media. And that's, I think, so much more insidious because I see it get shared by people who I know our voters and who actually do vote and who do care, because they seem like credible posts. And it all comes down to wanting to keep people from voting, because voting is like this shred of democracy that we're trying to hold on to.
Just a quick reminder, if you've got a mail-in ballot at home, get that in the mail by Tuesday, October 27th. That's the recommendation from the post office here in New Mexico. But you can also hand deliver your mail-in ballot at any early voting center around the state up through Halloween. After that, the polls will close for a couple days until Election Day. That's Tuesday, November 3rd. Your mail-in ballot has to be in your county clerk's office by 7 p.m. on Election Day, and you can hand deliver it. You can also register to vote and vote in person at those early voting centers up through Halloween. After that, you're out of luck if you haven't registered. This is No More Normal, and we are breaking down media literacy in the election season and what it means for our democracy. In the second half of the show, we're going to talk with a librarian who created a great online resource for how to tell fake news from the real stuff. We get tips on what we should do with disinformation we spot on the social networks, and I talk with the New Mexico chapter lead for media literacy now about teaching this stuff to young people. Stay with us. No More Normal is brought to you by Your New Mexico Government, a collaboration between KUNM, New Mexico PBS, and the Santa Fe Reporter. Funding for our coverage comes from the New Mexico Local News Fund, the Kellogg Foundation, and KUNM listeners like you. Support for public media provided by the Thornburg Foundation. Hear us each week on KUNM Sundays at 11 a.m. Find past episodes online at KUNM.org or wherever you look for podcasts. Many first-time voters have a lot on their mind this election cycle. College students are coming of age in an unprecedented time with the COVID-19 pandemic, civil uprisings for racial justice, and accelerating climate change. They're trying to figure it all out while keeping up with the remote classes and assignments. As a part of our Voices Behind the Vote series, UNM freshman Delaney Brigman spoke with KUNM about why voting is important to her and what young people want from their politicians.
I'm Delaney Brigman. I'm a freshman at UNM. My major is political science, and I have a really big passion for politics. And so since this is my first time voting in the first election, I actually am waiting to vote on the day of, because I think it's just such an important decision. And, you know, it's a part of our civil duty as an American citizen. And so I want to do it day of. But I think that our generation is actually pushing more towards voting. And I think that in the last election, a lot of the younger generation didn't show up, and we kind of suffered the consequences from that. So I think now that more people are going to vote, I think it'll be great. And I'm really excited to vote. I think voting is awesome. And I think that if people do want to discuss politics, then they have to say that they voted, because if you didn't vote, then you didn't act towards, you know, making a difference. I definitely do kind of side more with the quote-unquote left or the extreme, such as AOC or Bernie Sanders. I think that they are very passionate, and I like that they don't back down regardless of the backlash that they get. Bernie has said that he does not support fracking, whereas with Biden, he went back and forth with fracking, and now in the vice presidential debate, Kamala said that they do support fracking, and I just wish that politicians stuck with their gut and that money wasn't involved. So with the current election, Biden was not my first choice, but I will still vote for him. I just wish that he did take a more kind of progressive approach more than moderate. But I think a lot of voters tend to be scared of change. And I wish that people would just be open and willing to make a difference and see actually what happens, instead of just kind of wanting to stick with the social norm. So I do wish that some politicians were more representative. But I mean, hopefully with the election of Biden, we can make room for some more progressive ideas.
Thanks to KUNM's Taylor Velasquez for her profile. All right, now, let's hit pause for a second, okay? It's the end of October and the weather has been full of beautiful fall days here in New Mexico. But one thing we all know, it's going to get cold. Really cold. The colder weather is prime for coronavirus to spread. It's harder to be outside. Other bugs are floating around that might weaken your immune system. In fact, we had the highest number of new cases of COVID-19 emerge since the pandemic started. I know you have pandemic fatigue. I'm a homebody and even I want to get out of the house. But it's just not safe to do so. We're now in the third wave, and this one is predicted to hit harder than it has before. I know you want to go out to socialize, to see family, and actually hug them. You'll be all right. It's like riding a bike. You won't forget how to hug people. But we have to become even stricter with our movements and our activities. Stay in the house, unless you have to go to the store or if it's an emergency. Wash your hands, wear your masks. We've done a pretty good job. Now is not the time to ease up. Here's something special for you. We are re-airing last week's episode, The Real Crime, a deep look into how racist, fear-based campaigning warped the country's approach to crime. Listen in on Tuesday, October 27th at 8 a.m. on KUNM. If you miss it, you can always find the episode anywhere you get your podcasts. Fake news. It's a term we've heard a lot in the past 4 years. The term itself instills a distrust in media, information, and journalism. How can you tell what news is factual or fake? Benjamin Rideout is with the Albuquerque and Bernalillo County Public Library, and he created an online resource to help you get to what's true. I spoke with him about what inspired his creation. You created a resource that teaches how to spot disinformation. It's replete with keys on fact-checking, how to evaluate content on social media, even a chart with media bias in the news. This is truly awesome. Tell me, what gave you the idea to create this?
I saw a need and I had an interest, I guess. I came to the Albuquerque Public Library after having worked a fair number of years in academic university libraries and information literacy and how to show people to do research. And when I came here, I was the digital services manager at the time that I built this page. The same need was there for the public. It just wasn't being taught. And I was like, all right, I build web pages for a living. I maintain a public library's web page. I'm going to start putting something together. And I looked out across the internet and I actually came across a site web page from Indiana University East. That kind of information is what I want, but it's targeted to academics. How do I twist that and take that part out of it and just make it accessible for, you know, people that are curious?
Mm-hmm. Can you summarize any of the basic tips for our listeners?
Be critical. Don't take things at face value. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah.
The old saying, so if you're reading something and it fits your perceptions or your beliefs 100%, maybe you should question it. But whether you lean politically right or left, if it agrees with you 100%, you might not have all the facts. And if you question it, track down those sources. Look for other people that are talking about it. You know, get out of your bubble.
Yeah, and it's interesting because people have this refusal or apprehension to getting out of their bubble. And I believe that it's okay to be critical of yourself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've got to have all the perspectives out there to be who we are these days.
Exactly. You made this guide years ago. Do you think, it has relevance now in the election cycle?
It definitely has relevance now. So I built it in the fall of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was building it, our politicians were changing the definition of what fake news was. And that has just gone farther and farther astray in what my terminology was. But fake news is definitely a big issue. The way that we receive our filtered news makes it even more prone to happening, it seems.
How can people dig through their social media feeds and find the good stuff? Or should they just look somewhere else?
Probably some of both. Our culture seems to have embraced social media. We use it. So saying turning it off is, I don't know, how do you do that? So using social media, using normal media outlets. And so periodically, maybe go into, I use Facebook maybe more than some others, but go in and adjust your settings so that you can see something different for a while. And it keeps you looking a little bit farther.
Mm-hmm.
Or, if you see a story that you question, good or bad, maybe chase it down a little bit. Don't just scroll.
Yeah.
Don't just scroll. Interact with it.
How does it feel to be able to create this resource for people and to see them using it?
It's rewarding. It feels good. One of the things that we traditionally do in the library is we have story time. We have programming, you know, arts and crafts. We've got Lego clubs. Had, I should say. We had those things.
Yeah.
So having things like web pages where you can see people coming in and using them.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I want to thank you so much for everything that you do. And thank you very much for being on the show. He's Benjamin Rideout. He's with the Albuquerque and Bernalillo County Public Library. Thank you again for being with me.
Thank you very much, Khalil.
For 15 years, Generation Justice has been teaching and mentoring young people with a positive youth development approach to facilitate social change through the domains of racial equity, civic engagement, and media literacy. I had the honor of talking with its founder, Roberta Real, over Zoom about media literacy and our democracy. Can you briefly explain the difference between disinformation and misinformation, and what are the subtleties between the two?
So disinformation is information that is intentionally misconstrued or a narrative that is absolutely not true that is being constructed mm-hmm. for the purpose of making sure that people are confused, that can add chaos. And really, disinformation is about making sure that there is either political, capital, or power gain by somebody as a result of that disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
Misinformation is frequently just that people don't look at or vet the information that they're getting, and then they continue to share it and amplify that misinformation, but it isn't always with the same intention. However, it's important to note that both are very, very harmful and can even be deadly, as we've seen with this pandemic.
Yeah. Also, it's election season, and I feel like every election season we begin to get the election ads, and they seem to be full of disinformation and misinformation. I got a question about that. With this election season, it's ripe with all of these things, and they've created like mass confusion, yet the FEC, Federal Election Commission, has sat on its hands. The Honest Ads Act would kind of modernize campaign finance and regulate internet advertising in the same fashion that it's done with TV and radio. Is the passing of this act something that you support? And also, have you spoken to any lawmakers here in New Mexico about their support for this?
I haven't spoken with any lawmakers, and I appreciate the information that you're sharing and sharing to our listeners, Khalil. I think that you're right. There's these regulatory bodies like the FEC, as well as even the FCC, mm-hmm. that their job is to regulate. And what we're seeing in this administration is that the regulators are not necessarily acting or working on behalf of the people and what's in the best interest of the people. We're seeing throughout all across the board with this administration that any federal agencies are really, it's questionable if they're working on behalf of the people or if they're working on behalf of somebody, again, mm-hmm. gaining power, capital, or influence. It's a structural issue, right? Because it's an election season, but I think it's way beyond the fact that it's an election season. Tonight at 7 o'clock, I had the great fortune of interviewing one of the foremost researchers of disinformation, Dr. Joan Donovan, and she works out of the Harvard Kennedy Center and has been doing research on media manipulation, disinformation for many years. And so she's going to be talking with us about the history of this, which includes how there's always been disinformation, there's always been false narratives, and the work that you and I do on the platform that you and I have here at KUNM mm-hmm. is to really do narrative shift work.
Yeah.
And to hold narratives that are really true to our community. But disinformation really has increased as a result of unregulated social media platforms.
Yeah.
And have spread enormously as a result of those platforms not being regulated. And so you're talking about the FEC, and I can appreciate that. We really need to look at how Facebook, who also owns Instagram and Twitter and all of these other platforms, including Google, have not been held accountable to how information gets spread and how algorithms are set up in such a way that it's more important to get lots of clicks on something, irregardless mm-hmm. of what falsehood may be in that click or how harmful it may be to a particular sector of our community. Mm-hmm. And so there are several activists and advocates that have been working to push against these unregulated platforms. And we're seeing a tiny shift right now, but we're seeing a tiny shift at what, the 11th hour of this election that may be the most consequential election of our lifetime.
I agree.
My lifetime, and I'm old. And so they're shifting now, but there's a need and there will be a need beyond this election to continue to work on pushing against disinformation and helping to educate people about misinformation and how to clearly vet information that we share on all these platforms.
You know, what should I do if I see something on social media that I know is false and misleading that feels like pointing out bad information just really helps it go around? What can be done other than just flagging it?
These are some points that are coming from experts who have done a lot of research about both disinformation, media manipulation, and social media algorithms. Avoid amplification is one of the first things to do. Hmm. Avoid amplification. So frequently we see something online and we get upset and we have a knee-jerk reaction and we're like, I'm going to make a comment or I'm going to dislike that. I'm going to put a sad face emoji. That anything that we do actually amplifies the message. Social media algorithms feed on any kind of engagement, whether it's negative or positive. Mm. So when we react anyway, we're actually raising the disinformation.
Okay.
So just sometimes leave it alone, walk away from it. That is the best way to disempower it. Mm-hmm. Number two, report. If you encounter a piece of disinformation, flag it for removal from that social media network or submit it to a tip line for further evaluation. So if you want to do something, report it. Third, avoid cross-pollination. If you see a post on Facebook, avoid posting it on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I know, like, I'm personally on Twitter sometimes and I'm like, oh, I need to let people know on Facebook this is happening. Wrong. Do not do cross-pollination because, again, even if you're saying that it's incorrect, you're actually spreading the disinformation on other platforms. Mm-hmm. And inoculate. Prime your audience to distrust disinformation when they see it by naming the bad actor's motivation and sharing factual information from trusted sources that could encourage people to make a plan, for example, for voting. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important. And those are the actions that we can do. Let's find a vetted information piece and share that and then call out that this may be a piece of disinformation that is actually going to give whoever the bad actor is more power, mm-hmm. more capital, and more influence. Mm-hmm. And that is not what we want to do.
Yeah.
I hope that this is helpful.
She is Roberta Real. She is the creator and executive director of Generation Justice. She also works with the Disinformation League. Roberta, thank you so much. Don't forget, listen to Generation Justice at 7 p.m. tonight on KUNM. Will you come back on the show again?
Sure, Khalil.
Pamela Pereira is a media education expert, learning designer, researcher, and thought provoker. She's also the founder and director of Media Savvy Citizens, an organization that teaches media literacy to students. She also serves as the New Mexico chapter lead for Media Literacy Now. Okay, so Pamela, tell me, what is media literacy and why is it important to have our children learn about it?
This is a question we should all be asking ourselves often, right? Let's talk about media first. Because media, it's like this umbrella of any and all communication that is through a medium, meaning any communication that is not face-to-face, right? Mm-hmm. And so having a phone conversation, texting, memes, news, the internet, videos, YouTube videos, all of that is media, movies, billboards, the brand on somebody's shoes. Mm-hmm. That is media, right?
Okay.
And so media literacy is actually being able to understand it all, right? To process, to find information, to decode it, like decode it, meaning break it down, to understand it, evaluate it, meaning to be able to form an opinion around what their thoughts are after they've like analyzed it and evaluated, and create media, because we're all producers and consumers, right?
Yes.
And then sharing media or acting on that media, right? So that is, to be media literate is really to have fluency in a language of communication, in all communications, really. So that's what our entity does, Media Savvy Citizens, is we're working towards building fluency in children and adults.
How have you been able to work with teachers to really start that conversation about media literacy with the student? What type of tricks or innovations have come up?
We have a lot of tools that we've created for teachers, as far as like, how do you find credibility and what are the questions to ask, or bias, or even just the basic media literacy questions, which are five of them. And I could give those to you.
Please
if you're
do.
Curious.
Yes.
Okay. So some of those basic questions, whether you're looking at the news or any piece of media, a video, etc., is who is the author? What is the purpose of this piece of media, and why did somebody create it? What are the symbols and techniques that are used to attract my attention? Like what images, pictures, sounds, etc.? Whose voice is being represented? What is the point of view? And how do different audiences interpret the message? So if a certain voice is being represented, how might the voice that's not being represented interpret that message? And so it's author, purpose, symbols and techniques, representation and interpretation. And those are the five basic questions that we should be asking of media. Now, each question, like who is the author, has its own subset of questions, right?
Yes.
So like, is the author credible? Is it an individual? Is it a team? Who created the message? And when you're looking at purpose, it's not just like, well, why did somebody like, oh, they did this to entertain or to inform me or to sell me something. That might be the purpose, but also who paid for that message?
Yes.
Like what money is behind that message? And who was the intended audience for that message? Like, what was the purpose? Like, it, for what audience was that made and why?
Yeah.
Right. So those are the subset questions that, that go with the, within each section. And there's, you know, we can just go on and on because there's a lot to unpack and discover.
And finally, you know, the flood of information from memes, fake news, opinion pieces, bots, real news during the pandemic gets really, really overwhelming. All of us are overwhelmed with this. Do you think media literacy can help people parse all of that, maybe find a calmer pace and real information?
Yes, that's for sure. Media literacy helps us make sense of our world, right? Helps us understand and have some basic skills. And some of those questions is the beginning. And also, like, there is a lot of information. Being faster and quicker, sifting through the information is a media literacy skill. To be able to say, like, oh, this is an opinion. Oh, this is a fact. Oh, this is a credible source. Oh, this is coming from this university or et cetera, or the Poynter Institute or whatever different credible sources when we're talking about journalism. Yes, media literacy really gives you like a foundation, whether you're looking at news or whether you're looking at any information about anything. People can shut off the information, but also some people won't.
Yes.
So it's, what do you look at? What kind of bias does it have? What kind of point of view does it have? And what context is it in? Like, was the transparency revealed? Did anybody take money to put that message together? Like, who's funding them?
Yeah.
Like, are these sources that they're putting out there reliable? Asking these questions, continually asking these questions, and also going through a process of, how do I do this? It feels really big and overwhelming. So yes, media literacy, which encompasses digital literacy, tech literacy, information literacy, digital citizenship, media literacy umbrellas all those things.
It is a life skill for us all. I would thank you again so much for being on the show. She is Pamela Pereira. She is the New Mexico chapter head of Media Literacy Now. She's also with Media Savvy Citizens. This is a lifelong thing, and there's more to break down.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next week, we're digging into our ballots. No endorsements, but we'll be breaking down all of the initiatives and other important things voters are tackling next Sunday on The Mono. Comedian Sarah Kennedy is a good friend of the show. We always love having her on for her humor, wit, and perspective. Check out episode 2 of The Mono, Disappearing Acts, to hear her story, The Chicken Chase. Sarah dropped a line to The Mono HQ to give us a little moment of levitation.
You know, I like to think of myself as a person who is up on the goings-on in Albuquerque and New Mexico at large. And just like all my fellow New Mexicans, I have been watching all of the numbers around coronavirus rise and fall. And when I say that, I do mean only rise. And honestly, the rising numbers could possibly do a good thing here, if only because it means that more people will be doing what they're supposed to be doing in the first place and stop stoking all this FOMO. This show is no more normal. Well, we need no more FOMO. Like, everybody just stay home. Stay home!
That's all for this week. We want to thank all of our guests for appearing on the show and sharing their insights and expertise. We want to thank Taylor Velasquez from KUNM for the awesome voter profile. Vote Taylor Velasquez. I said it first, trust me. Many thanks to the editing team of Ty Bannerman, Taylor Velasquez, and Kaveh Movahed for helping cut up the show and make it sound so tight. Super thanks to Larry Schulte and Vanessa Bowen for providing art for the online post of this episode. Special thanks to Jazz Tone, the producer, Cheo, Dom Life, and Old Lord Records for providing music for the show. Jackie, Pope Yes Yes Y'all, and Bigawatt have produced some of the show's themes. No More Normal is executive produced by Marisa DeMarco. It's produced and hosted by yours truly. I'm Khalil Ekolona. For everyone here at The Mono, thanks for listening.